Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on December 6th, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how this call is going to work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, that means that you've logged in correctly. Because we expect more than 100 participants today, we did ask for questions to be submitted via email, and some of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the question box your name as you entered it while logging on to the call so that we can ask your question. We will then unmute you and when we call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order of when you submitted your name in the question box. Once we unmute you, you will be prompted by the system that you have been unmuted, and you will now be able to speak for all of us to hear. Now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have Peter Steffen, the director of the Tax Resolution Institute. Most of you will recognize Peter as our presenter and instructor of our many seminars and webinars found on our website at taxresolutioninstitute.org. Peter is qualified by the California Board of Accountancy in all states, the Internal Revenue Service, State Bar of California, State Bar of New York, and several other states to provide continuing professional education to attorneys, certified public accountants, and enrolled agents in the area of tax resolution. Peter has authored the textbook, The Ultimate Guide to Tax Resolution, as well as several tax resolution manuals providing fellow professionals with a one-of-a-kind instruction allowing them to resolve all types of tax resolution issues. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Peter Steffen.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, and welcome, everyone. We're going to get quickly into the questions here today. We may not have time to take additional questions, but let's see how quickly it goes. First off, why are we here today? Sure, the Tax Resolution Institute does seminars, webcasts, webinars, e-learning, and the like. All can be found at taxresolutioninstitute.org. But more importantly, what we do is a little bit different than most people in this business. We are here to help you make more money. We're here to teach you how to become a tax resolution specialist. We want to become your partner, working side by side to fix your clients' IRS and state income, payroll, and tax audit issues. And if you find that you're over your head, or this is a business that you don't care to be in, because it does take a certain type, it's a very aggressive business, we want to become your trusted referral source. So again, my name is Peter Steffen, the director of the Tax Resolution Institute. I've been doing this work, I've been certified for 38 years and been doing this work for 25 of them. We're going to get right into the questions. Joe, let's go with the first one submitted.
All right, Peter. Yes, and as a reminder to everyone, subscribers do get priority when it comes to submitting these questions. So the first one is from a subscriber. Fred is asking, what will appeals allow to be added to the OIC application after the rejection? And just a little background, he says, without informing me, client took out a family loan a month prior to filing the OIC application to pay. Legal and professional fees, car repairs, funds to pay the remaining 80% of the offer, prior loans from friends, son's college costs. It looks like he didn't qualify for a student loan. And she is paying back $500 a month. Could part of this $500 be positioned as legal and professional fees and car repairs as expenses for production of income? That's part of the question. He has several going on here, Peter. He also says, how do we present the position of financial hardship when the loan payback is an unsecured family loan that will remain a burden for about 3.5 years? IRS says he has $411 a month to pay, and the amount available is far less due to the $500 a month loan repayment.
All right, well, that's a mouthful. So let's take a piece at a time. What will appeals allow to be added to the offer application after rejection? The real answer is anything. If you have a legitimate adjustment to the offer, and typically that's not the case, there are certain When an offer is submitted, the offer specialist will give to you what we call an AET and an IET. That's the analysis of assets and the analysis of income. And typically, there'll be some item or items there that you will disagree with. So you will substantiate those items to the appeals officer, and they'll either be allowed or disallowed. There's no reason that you can't add another item that either was omitted or maybe became relevant between the time that the offer was submitted, which at that point may have been as much as 2 years ago. Remember, the IRS has up to 2 years to reject the offer. If they do not reject it in writing, it is deemed accepted after 24 months. So that's a little aside. So the answer is, on appeal, bring up anything that you think is relevant without sounding like you're recreating the wheel, redoing the entire offer. As to this family loan that was taken out a month prior to filing the OIC application, I think a small portion of it you may be able to get away with listing on the offer form as legal and professional fees, although typically the IRS doesn't allow very much for our fees, for example, as a monthly payment against the offer amount. As far as the car repairs and the son's college costs and the like, I seriously doubt that the IRS is going to allow any of that. Remember, the maximum on autos comes from the IRS national and local standards, both for the cost of the car and the monthly operating expenses. So I'm not sure, you know, how this comes into play or why the question is being asked, and likely they're not allowing any portion of that loan that we use for car repairs anyway. So at best, you're going to get a little bit for professional fees, and that might be about it. The loan payback is an unsecured loan, and therefore the IRS is not going to allow the payment. I see what, Fred, what you want to do here, and you want to take the 411 that is now calculated as the disposable income and reduce it by the loan repayment of 500, and that's not going to fly. I can almost guarantee you that. Your best bet is to try to reduce the 411 by some other amounts, some other items that may qualify against the offer to reduce disposable income. But remember, the $411 is multiplied by 12 is $4,932. You don't say exactly how much is owed here, but assuming the taxpayer does not have substantial assets, $4,932 is not such a bad number, especially because you can pay it over 5 months, and it actually takes quite some time to get through the system. So you'll have way more than 5 months to come up with the full payment. So I hope that answers the question. It's a mouthful, but if you have any further questions, shoot us an email, and I'll try to elaborate further. Joe, next question.
Thank you, Peter. Yes, Jim is asking, I will try to make this as simple as possible. Divorced taxpayers, X, filed a joint return, claimed the kids, and received the EIC in 2010, fraudulently after the year of the divorce. Taxpayer filed a head of household return and claiming the two kids. The IRS disallowed the deductions on his EIC because she had already filed, even though he has sole custody. The ex is a junkie. The IRS has now issued a garnishment for the taxes due from his wages. What options do we have?
All right. Well, you know, this is a more of a generic tax prep question, and of course we do north of 500 traditional annual tax returns of all types here at the Tax Resolution Institute and SST CPAs. We also do approximately the same amount of delinquent returns. So we do have a little bit of tax prep experience, and I've got to guess that I've prepared well over 20,000 tax returns in my career. So let me take a shot at this for you, Jim. I think that you are fighting a losing battle on this earned income credit issue, even though the ex filed it in the year after. Theoretically, and you don't say, but I assume that the taxpayer's ex who filed, who got the EIC in 2010, actually got the earned income credit, which means that no matter what you do, you're not going to get it twice. So I think you're fighting a losing battle there. You can try to appeal it by going to the taxpayer advocate. That's form 911. But I think you're wasting a lot of time and a lot of money. Remember, in this business, you may have a winner, but it's all about prize and price. We're not going to, just like in a tax audit, even if you're right, we're not going to spend, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 in legal and accounting fees to chase a $500 or $1,000 tax savings. So you always have to be a bit pragmatic, a bit practical about this, and evaluate the prize and the price. Now, the fact that the ex is a junkie is not relevant. The only time that may have some relevance, and that is if you can document it. It's not just with police reports or psychologists or psychiatrists or whatever it might be, would be for penalty abatement purposes. You may have some case there if the ex is a junkie. Otherwise, it's not very relevant information. I know you want it to be. I know at some level it should be, but in our experience, only for penalty abatement purposes would that apply. Now, the final piece of the question here is that the IRS has now issued a garnishment for the taxes from his wages. So what options do we have? Well, Jim, we have the same options as we always have. So streamline installment agreement, currently non-collectible status, offering compromise, any of those are possibilities. Any of those solutions are possibilities. You have to prepare a collection information statement. And let me remind everybody out there, because we talk about this in quite some depth and detail in our 8-hour and now 16-hour seminars coming up. In fact, the next one is coming up this Friday and Saturday in Orange County, California, at National University, in conjunction with the Orange County Society of Enrolled Agents. You can attend live in person, or we webcast it. We'll talk about a deal we're going to make the people on the telephone here only in a few minutes, but we talk about this in depth and detail. If you are dealing with ACS, automated collections, the collection information statement that you're going to prepare in this instance is going to be a 433F. If you're dealing with a revenue officer directly, you're going to use the collection information statement, the 433A. So remember that so you don't have to do the work twice. Of course, if you decide to do an offer and compromise, get a hold put on collection activity. You'll probably have to show a copy of the offer to either ACS or the revenue officer. They should be cooperative. And that, of course, is another alternative, submitting an offer in compromise for the liability. So, Jim, I hope that answers the question. So let's move on. Joe?
Yes, Osman is asking, I have read that the Internal Revenue Service is going to start using private contractors to collect past due taxes. Is this true? And if so, how will it affect the tax resolution industry?
Well, Usman, that's an interesting question, and I think you already know the answer. We don't know. I can only tell you what happened years ago when they tried to use outside collection agencies. The IRS from time to time figures out that they're overwhelmed. In fact, we actually have a seminar slide this coming up this weekend that talks about the number of hang-ups that that taxpayers and taxpayer practitioners experienced in the last year, and it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of the calls. So I think the IRS has finally surrendered and decided that if they really do want to collect the tax, then they're going to have to either add employees or hire outside contractors to do the collection. Now, that said, the outside private contractors, the collectors, are required to adhere to the same standards as the tax compliance people, whether they're revenue at ACS. Revenue officers have their own set of standards that is the live revenue officers you deal with. But when you call one of the service centers, you get a varying degree of people with expertise, people that everyone from revenue officers to the tax compliance people. So you can see that you can get a wide variety of experience calling ACS. So I would now, if you ask me to take a guess here, I would say that it's going to start pretty light because they're going to make sure that the taxpayers that owe money to the IRS, and by the way, there are 13 million taxpayers that owe money to the IRS. There are 26 million taxpayers that either owe money to the IRS or disagree with the amounts owed. So that's out of 156 million or so tax returns. You can see that this is a huge, huge business here. And I want everyone, there's plenty of business for us all. I want everyone on this call to consider getting their piece of the pie. I suspect, though, as we move down the road, that these private contractors are going to get more and more aggressive in their collection efforts. And I think when that happens, the same thing is going to happen that happened many years ago, which is the IRS is going to abandon the private contractor issues, farm outs, because they're not going to be able to appropriately control them. The complaints are going to start getting high, and the IRS is going to spend more time investigating the complaints, hearing appeals, having the taxpayer advocate involved and the like, and for it to be worth it. So to answer your question, I think it'll go on for a year or two, and I think the IRS is once again going to abandon that private contractor methodology for collection. Joe, let's move on to the next question.
All right, next one is Henry. I have a situation with husband and wife, both residents of California, filing a joint return. They owe a lot of income taxes to the IRS. The wife has been criminally convicted relating to tax evasion and also has to pay restitution. I know they cannot file a joint offering compromise because of the restitution issue. My question is, if the husband files a separate offering compromise and the IRS accepts the offer, can the IRS collect against the husband given that his income is community income?
All right, Henry, good question. In fact, we have an almost identical situation in the office here as we speak. And let me bring everybody else on the call up to speed as to what you're talking about, Henry. The taxpayer has been criminally convicted, and the significance of that is that because the taxpayer, as part of the plea agreement, perhaps not to go to jail or perhaps to have a shorter period of incarceration, cannot do an offer in compromise. So the if it's husband and wife, the wife has already been criminally convicted, then the wife is going to have an ongoing problem here because she cannot do an offer in compromise because of that criminal conviction, and it's the restitution issue that's the reason that she cannot do it. So now coming to your question, that's correct. They cannot file a joint offer in compromise. So you would file an offer in compromise for the husband. Now remember that the husband and wife on a joint return are both jointly and severally liable for the tax on the return. If it were just tax, then they could do a joint OIC if this wasn't a criminal case and there wasn't restitution involved. So you would do an offer and compromise, doubt as to collectability, for the husband and hope that that flies. Now, the fact that the income is community income is not really the issue. The issue is this. When you have a community property state, California being one of them, and you prepare an offer in compromise, income counts and assets don't. So what that means is that when the husband submits the offer in compromise for his 100% share of the liability, they can still go after the wife. He's got to use the wife's income as well as his income. If, for example, they own a home and it's a community property state and the home has $100,000 in equity in it, calculated using the IRS OIC formula, which is 80% less the mortgage, then the husband's share of the equity in the home or any other asset for that matter has to be added to the offer. So, in short, income counts, assets don't, and the husband can do an offer and compromise, and if he qualifies, it will be accepted, but it will not let the criminally convicted wife who owes restitution off the hook. Let me just interject something here while we're on this subject, because I noticed that we have a variety of very interesting questions. So far, we have at least one generic tax question. And of course, I suggest that you take either one day or 2 days of the seminar coming up this Friday and Saturday on November the 4th and 5th. In fact, it's basically 2 days for the price of one. And we'll send you the agenda so you don't have to attend 8 hours each day if you don't want to. But I want to tell you a story about what happened to me many years ago and how I decided to solve the problem for all of you out there and all of the people who visit us at taxresolutioninstitute.org. I remember when I was first in practice, and I'm talking 30 years ago, so I'll date myself 30 plus years ago, and I ran into questions like these. In fact, I ran into some very complex, very complicated general tax questions. So, you know, being wanting to build my practice, wanting to serve the clients well, I would go to the law library, I would do research. Then I would beg somebody's tax service, RIA or CCH, somebody I knew at a CPA firm. And by the time that I called the so-called expert to maybe beg 5 minutes of their time, I already knew more than they did. But the price that I paid was tremendous. I would do hours, sometimes dozens of hours of free research. And you know you can't charge clients for your inexperience. because there are people out there that have answers to these questions right off the top of their head. I almost said people like me, but even today I don't know everything. I sure know a lot more than I knew 30 years ago. So I asked myself just a few years ago, what's the solution? What can I do to provide a solution to this problem? What we created here at TaxResolutionInstitute.org is a program where, in addition to getting seminars, getting webinars, getting e-learning, getting a free copy of The Ultimate Guide to Tax Resolution, and the like, we created a subscription program that gets you 1, 2, or 3 hours annually of consultation time by one of the lawyers or myself or one of the highly trained CPA specialists in this business that you can pick up the phone and call and get an answer to your question, usually in the first call. But if for some reason we can't take the call right away, you will get an answer within 24 hours. And that's live on the telephone and or by email. So save yourself those dozens of hours of research and all the stress that goes along with trying to get some of these more complex tax controversy questions and general tax questions answered, because typically what happens, they come at the busiest time of the year, and you don't have that, you don't have the time to spend on research. Furthermore, bill your client for your time and our time. So check us out at TaxResolutionInstitute.org on that subscription program. That's the way I solve the problem for you, and I can only say that I wish I had it 30 years ago. Let's move on, Joe.
Okay, next one is from Peter. I have a client who is on uncollectible status since last November. Since a year will have passed, I believe that the IRS will begin collection proceedings starting today, Tuesday the 1st. Client is working on a month-to-month contract and being paid on a W-2. Client owes taxes for years 2001 through 2008 and also for 2012 and 13. Taxes and penalties outstanding total about $90,000. The 10-year statute expires for tax years 2005 on August 20, 2017 for about $20,000. 2002 and 4 on 9/24/2017 for about $11,000. 2006 on October 2017. So before I prepare an offer, are there any suggestions as to how I can delay things so as to allow the statute to take effect? Client was out of work for a couple of years until mid-2015 and staying with various friends, sometimes paying minimal rent and catching up with expenses from the past few years. Since client is working on a month-to-month basis, client could be out of work at the end of any given month. Client believes that if the IRS sends a levy notice to employer, that the employer would not offer client a full-time permanent position.
Okay. Just a comment for everybody out there. We don't need all the fluff. It's all very nice, but about a third of this question is irrelevant. Anyway, Peter, let me answer your question because I think you have a couple of misconceptions here, but there are a few things you should be aware. First of all, your comment regarding being in uncollectible status since last November, and that in a year the IRS will resume collection activity, is not necessarily correct. Sure, it's possible that the IRS can resume collection activity at any time after an installment agreement or currently non-collectible status, CNC status, is put in place. However, typically the IRS will leave you alone, will leave you in an installment agreement, and leave you in CNC status for 2 years before they revisit it. So please let me know if that is not the case in your case here. But I don't think I'd be worrying about Tuesday, November the 1st today as 1 year has passed, because I don't think they're coming. Furthermore, they're going to have to send you another notice of intent to levy. You know that notice, the one that says urgent? We intend to levy upon certain assets. And that will start the clock ticking, and 30 days plus processing time, they'll be able to garnish pay, levy bank accounts, or do a third-party levy. So we have a two-year period, not a one-year period. So you go on to say that the client is on a W-2, so that's fine. Well, hopefully he's in compliance for the current year, which is important, and that he owes taxes for a number of years spanning from 2001 through 2013. Okay, without getting into all of the details of what taxes are owed for what years, because it's not relevant whether it's $1 or $100,000 per year, everyone out there should know that there is a 10-year statute for collection. Now, this is assuming that there were no tolling events, no events that would toll the statute of limitations. So, for example, if a 2005 return was filed timely in 2006 and there were no tolling events, the collection statute would have expired for that 2005 return on April 16th, 2016. On extension, it would have just expired on October 16th, 2016. So we have that 10-year collection statute. Again, you must get the IRS transcripts and determine that there were no tolling events. You'll be surprised that many, many things toll the statute for collection. An installment agreement for federal purposes does not. The IRS would like that to happen, but it does not. CNC status does not. However, filing a CDP, which is a collection due process, tolls the statute. A CAP, collection appeals procedure, tolls the statute. We go over every appeal imaginable in our 8 and 16-hour seminars, as I said, coming up here on Friday and Saturday. If you can't make it, go to taxresolutioninstitute.org, buy the DVD, but do take a seminar, because if you're going to be in this business, then you should be aware of many of the finer points, as most of which we can't get into today. So, Moving along with the question here, not relevant that the client's been out of work, except to say that he started again in the mid-2015 and has been paying some rent and so on and so forth to friends. We know he could be out of work at any given month, but remember, the IRS look-back period, and I don't think you have to worry about any of this because I don't think they're coming. I think you have another year. But before collection activity resumes. But remember, everyone, the look-back period for collection, for the collection information statement, even for, in most cases, offers in compromise, although there are some twists and turns for offer purposes, is 3 months. So think about it. If you want to get the right result for your client, you're going to do some planning, and you're going to do 3 months of planning, so you give the IRS what they want to see. Now, I'm not saying do anything that there's any skullduggery here, but you sure can pick the right 3 months and time your collection information statement accordingly if you have a client that has sporadic income, especially if it's W-2 income. The other way to do it is just to go back to the beginning of the year and average 9 months or 10 months, as long as it's not more than 60 days or so old. The IRS will accept it on the collection information statement done, again, for a revenue officer on a 433A or for ACS on a 433F. The fact that the IRS sends a levy notice to the employer, of course, it's problematic if it's going to upset the employer in such a way that they offer him a full-time position, but it's your job, Peter, to get in front of this so that doesn't happen. The only way the IRS is going to send a wage garnishment or a third-party levy to the employer is if you or your client ignores them. Otherwise, the employer will never know unless a lien is filed and the employer does a check for that. So I hope that answers your question. And once again, you know, these finer points of the tax resolution business, of the collection information statements, of offers in compromise, and the like. I mean, there are many, many areas, including dischargeability of taxes in bankruptcy, of subordination agreements, certificate of release of federal tax liens, and so on, are covered in our two-day seminar that we're giving in conjunction with the Orange County Society of Enrolled Agents this coming Friday and Saturday, November the 4th and November the 5th. Pick and choose if you don't want to spend 16 hours and you do get continuing professional education, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a CPA, or whether you're an enrolled agent from either the Orange County Society of Enrolled Agents for EAs or from the Tax Resolution Institute for any of the three categories of lawyers, CPAs, and enrolled agents. So let's move on to the next question, Joe.
Dana asks, a taxpayer was audited per the 1099-K matching program, which covered 4 years, for which he had not filed, particular years 2011 to 2014. The returns were complex to prepare, therefore the auditor based most of the scrutiny on the earliest year, which was prepared first. Due to the subsequent information received by the preparer, the IRS allowed the original return to be adjusted to a substantial NOL, which is being allowed to carry forward. Per the IRS, the taxpayer will need to file amended returns for the next 2 years to claim the credit carry forward. Should I assume that these amendments will prompt another audit of the returns? Notice of tax due has already been received for the amounts due on the three subsequent years. Any suggestions?
Well, several comments and several suggestions here, Dana. First of all, I assume that the NOL will be allowed to be carried forward as opposed to, because that's an election, so as opposed to being carried back for 2 years first. So I'm first assuming that there is no income in the prior 2 years to carry back to, in which case no harm, no foul, you must carry forward. Otherwise, I know that on an original return, an election to carry forward and forego the carry back period needs to be made. So let's assume for the moment that the revenue agent adjusted and allowed the NOL. That doesn't necessarily mean they can carry it forward, is what I'm saying. So first verify that. Assuming they can carry it forward and the amended returns get filed, it will probably offset some or all of the tax in the subsequent years. As you indicate, two of those years there are notices of tax due that have already been received. So I'm assuming, reading between the lines here, that the NOL at some level will reduce the tax in the first year, probably to zero, because you say you can carry it to at least 2 years, and then reduce the tax in the second year to something less than that which is owed. So that being the case, the challenge that you're going to have is that amended returns are now taking somewhere between 6 and 18 months, so let's call it 9 months and be conservative, to get worked by the IRS. And the IRS is, you know, here's this story too often. What we do is we get duplicate originals of the amended returns and try to sell it that way when we speak to a revenue officer, a collector. The problem you have, Dana, is that revenue agents are the people who do the audits. They add income, they throw out deductions, and the like. when they're finished with their job and they create this NOL or whatever it might be, when they're finished, if there's any tax owed, or if there's any tax owed for returns that have not been audited, revenue officers handle that. Now, it is not potato, potato. Revenue agents do certain things. They add income. They throw out deductions. At the end of the audit, by way of example, they ask you, they say you owe $20,000. Can you pay? If the answer is no, they tell you to have a great day and they move on to the next taxpayer. What they also do, though, is send it through the system, send it over to revenue officers. Revenue officers are the collectors. I will tell you that revenue agents, 95% of them, don't know anything about collection. And revenue officers, a good 95% of them, don't know anything about audit. So the problem you have here is that you're mixing and matching. Your collection issue is going to be with a revenue officer. And the revenue officer is going to hear the story about the amended returns. Not really going to care until they're processed or posted. You may get a flexible revenue officer who will put a hold on collection activity and perhaps at least examine, and I don't mean examine as in detail, but examine to determine that in fact was filed the amended return. So I would get a duplicate original amended return signed by your client. I would take a run at the revenue officer once you get the notice of intent to levy, so buy as much time as you can. When you get the notice of intent to levy, not just the notice of tax due, because remember, when you file a tax return and don't pay, you get four notices, and you have about a month or more in between each of the notices before it becomes serious. Serious meaning third-party levy, bank levy, wage garnishment, aggressive collection activity. When you get that fourth notice, that notice of intent to levy, urgent, we intend to levy upon certain assets, that's your call to action. So hopefully the amended return will be posted by then, and you can have an easy conversation with the revenue officer. So my suggestion is to wait until you get the urgent notice of notice of intent to levy, the one that says urgent, we intend to levy upon certain assets, to buy as much time as you can. You then have 30 days. I would wait. I would have my work all teed up and ready to go, and I would wait 25 days or so into that before I called either ACS or a revenue officer, and that depends, that's assigned based on the amount owed. Another way you can buy more time, if the amount owed is over $250,000, they keep changing it from $100 to $250. I'm not sure if they're going to go somewhere in between at some point, but another way to postpone collection activity is if the client owes more than $250,000 and the case is still with ACS, to call ACS and ask that it be assigned to a revenue officer. That should buy you another 6 months by the time it gets assigned to a local revenue officer, the group manager, who then assigns it to a revenue officer, who then contacts you. So there are many strategies you can use here. We talk about these in our 8-hour seminar. We talk about them in some of our live and pre-recorded 2-hour webinars and webcasts. So hopefully that answers your question. I do want to say one more thing. We have a couple more questions left. Actually, Joe, let's move on. Let's take this next question, and we'll get back to this other interesting point that I want to bring up in a moment.
All right. Next one is from Joe. My client was self-employed, failed to pay several years income/payroll taxes. He has no assets to speak of, Lien is already in place and he is now an employee. Revenue officer is involved and she issued a summons to appear at her office. We're not going to go, and I believe client may qualify for CNC status until we can file an offer. Other than the RO's continued enforced collection activity, are there any dire consequences from simply not showing up?
Well, Joe, I don't suggest. I strongly urge you to show up. There's no reason not to show up. Try by first picking up the phone and calling the revenue officer and asking what he or she wants. This could be, you don't indicate the dates as to the client being self-employed. In fact, self-employed could mean a lot of things. Some people call somebody self-employed if they were an S-Corp or an LLC. That would actually be treated very differently than self-employed as a Schedule C. And the reason I say that is that your client, as a self-employed individual, is personally liable, as you well know already, for 100% of the payroll taxes, the interest and the penalties, and of course the income tax that you indicate is owed here. If, in fact, your client was the sole owner of a C-Corp, an S-Corp, an LLC, an entity, you have opportunity here because he is only responsible for the trust fund portion of the payroll tax liability. So if that's the case, you can be a hero to the client and cut that payroll tax liability probably in about half. Now, the fact that he has no assets to speak of at some level is a good thing. The lien is the lien, but if it doesn't attach to anything like a piece of real estate, a personal residence, or something like that, it's not real relevant, is it? Although it will stay and hang around, floating out there, waiting to attach to something for the next 10 years. If the revenue officer issued a summons, I recommend that you call her, try to solve it on the telephone, but if you cannot, you should appear. Do not go as you are indicating you're going to do here. If your client qualifies for CNC status, which you say you believe they may, prepare a 433F. I'm sorry, a 433A. You said you're with a live revenue officer, so that's the collection information statement you will use, and show that there is little or no disposable income. Remember, by the way, when you prepare a 433A or F or even an offer in compromise, don't show something that goes too negative, because the obvious question is going to be, if it's too negative, how are they surviving every month? And you don't want to get into that conversation. Are there any dire consequences from simply not showing up? Sure, they could be, and they're too dire to even get into here. They can take a lot of action against your client, not to mention, Joe, that all you're going to do is stir the pot. All you're going to do is make them mad, and there's no reason to do that because this is probably a very innocuous thing. It could be a 4180 interview. You might want to ask why they want you in the office. If you don't know what a 4180 interview is, it is the one-on-one interview that determines who the responsible person is for payroll taxes and the trust fund recovery penalty. We have one more generic tax question. Then I have a few announcements. We could probably take one question, perhaps two, if you email them in. Joe, why don't you read the last one, because it's a very quick answer.
Yes, Jeffrey.
We'll go from there.
Jeffrey's asking, what are the consequences of filing a Form 966 late, and how can you remedy or fix a late filing?
All right. Well, first of all, for everyone out there, the Form 966 is a corporate dissolution or liquidation. It basically puts the IRS on notice that the corporation is closing down. Now that I say that, as a practical matter, when you check the final box on the final return, you're pretty much done. The IRS knows it's your last return, and that the assets were distributed and the like. The 966 is the formal, and you should file it. I'm not suggesting that you don't, but I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of cases over the last 35-plus years where the 966 was never filed, and I never saw any consequences of not filing it. If you have a larger company, or if you have a company that's distributing assets to the shareholders, you should file the 966, the corporate dissolution or liquidation form. It is required under Section 6043A of the IRC, but kind of like minutes, the annual minutes to a corporation, for a corporation, a small business, how many of our clients don't ever get around to it? I'm not saying it's exactly like that, but close enough. It is a very simple form. It literally is less than one page. It is about 60% of one page. The rest of the page one and two are instructions. So I would file it if the company is being dissolved, and just comply. So I hope that answers your question. Before we move on to questions, I want to talk to you about something that for me is very exciting. By popular demand, and for the last time at no charge, the one-hour webinar entitled How to Pick Low-Hanging Fruit, our low-hanging fruit webinar, four ways to make $1,000 or more an hour, is going to be rebroadcast. Joe, is it Wednesday or Thursday?
It's on Thursday, Peter.
Thursday, 10 a.m.?
10 a.m., yes.
It's going to be rebroadcast Thursday at 10 a.m. If you haven't taken it, aside from the seminar on Friday and Saturday, it will be your last chance to get this webinar free. After that, it's going to be priced at about $199 for the hour. I guarantee that if you don't make 10 times your money, even if you bought this in the year after you take this one-hour webinar, then I'll give you your money back. Everybody that has attended has written in and told me and thanked me and told me how much money they've made. I'll show you how to make $1,000 or more an hour picking what I call low-hanging fruit in the tax resolution, tax controversy business. And by the way, that's only four pieces. In our seminars, we give you more. So anyway, Thursday, Pacific time, low-hanging fruit. Contact us at taxresolutioninstitute.org to sign up for this Thursday. In fact, we will not be in the office on Thursday because we're setting up for the seminar at National University for Friday and Saturday. Joe, do we have some write-in questions? Because I have one here, but go on. Let's take a question from the audience.
Yes, we have someone that was very quick to the draw here. Very first question is from Sean. Sean is asking, my client received a letter that his OIC was received on September 3rd, 2016 at Centralized OIC. Another letter was received on October 20th. Saying that the OIC was transferred to Atlanta, Georgia for investigation. The contact person says, manager review for investigation, is this a normal part of the process or is there something wrong with the offer?
I wouldn't read into it. They do a lot of strange things with offers. In fact, as most of you know, but it bears repeating, the offers start in two places depending on where you, one of two places depending on where you live. For example, if you're in California, the offer will start in Memphis, Tennessee. If you're in some other areas, the only other place for an offer to start is in New York. So it either goes to Tennessee or it goes to New York. They determine at these centralized offer units that the offer is processable, that it has the application fee, that there's not some egregious errors. The offers then go back to local revenue officers in usually in your district, but not necessarily. And that's probably what's happening here. So I would not read into it. Remember, the IRS has up to 2 years to accept an offer or reject it in writing, and you still have your appeal rights at that point in time. If you let a few more months go by, I would say let at least 4 or 5 months go by, and you're anxious, pick up the phone and call the person whose name's on the letter and find out what the status is. But otherwise, do not read into it. Everything's good. Got another one, Joe?
Yes, we got another one here from Edward. Edward is asking about installment agreements. He says, when preparing an installment agreement, do the assets figure into the calculation since we consider income and expenses to come out with the monthly installment amount? So he's asking whether or not we take into consideration the assets when determining the payment amount.
The answer to the question is no. There are two pieces to the preparation of an installment agreement, whether you use a 433A or a 433F. One is assets. I'll tell you how that might enter into it in a moment. But the other is disposable income. So, you know, people think that the amount of the liability drives the amount of the payment. And nothing could be further from the truth. The ability to pay is what drives the payment. So if you have $300 a month in disposable income, either using actual numbers or IRS national or local standards, you're going to pay $300 a month whether you owe $50,000, $500,000, or $5 million. Now, let's talk about assets for a moment, because maybe this is really your question. If you have assets that have substantial equity in them, the IRS will require you to liquidate them or to get a lender letter in the case of, let's say, a personal residence that says that they won't lend you any money that you can give to the IRS. So many times we see taxpayers with equity in their personal residences that owe a substantial amount of tax, let's say $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000, and they have equity. So the IRS takes 80% of the home's value, less the mortgage, and they say, gee, there's some left over. Go to the bank and get a loan. Well, you know, the bank will not give them a loan with the tax liens and so on and so forth, but you need to get something in writing that shows that you applied for a loan and you were rejected. This holds true for whatever assets you might have. If they're available to sell, the IRS may require you to sell them. If they're available to borrow against, the IRS will want substantiation that you tried to borrow against them. So that is the only way. I'm sure there are some of that 1% of everything, but by and large, that's the way that assets are going to play into the calculation here. Of the payment amount. We are just about out of time here today. We will take these questions and we'll put them at the top of the queue on, what is it, Joe? December the 6th?
December 6th, yes.
December the 6th on Tax Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Pacific time. Remember, it's always the first Tuesday of the month. We take all tax questions. However, we do like to focus on tax controversy, tax resolution questions. And remember why we're here today. We're here to help you make money. Unlike many people in the seminar, webinar, webcast business who want to sell you a webinar or a live seminar, sure, we want to do that. You know, we're in business too, but we approach it by trying to help you make money. My opinion is we get up in the morning, we get our uniforms on, We come to the game. Why not make as much money as we can? I'm going to help you do that. I've been doing this a long time. My name is Peter Steffen, the director of the Tax Resolution Institute, and this is TRI. See you next time.